You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of March, 2018, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Daniel Bage. On today's show,
I will once again be stressing the United Kingdom's unconditional commitment to the future security of Europe, and I believe that together we can work to ensure that we overcome the challenges that we all face.
British Prime Minister Theresa May is in Brussels calling on European nations to get tough on Russian spy networks. My guests Kathleen Burke and Stephen Diel are here to discuss this and the day's other top stories, including U.S. President Donald Trump was warned by his top advisors not to congratulate Vladimir Putin on his re-election victory, but made a point of doing so anyhow. Why, oh why, does Mr. Trump care about his personal relationship with Mr. Putin? And who is collecting our online data, and what are they doing with it? Holland says no thank you to allowing intelligence agencies to gather more of their data. Plus, China has announced plans to merge state radio and television networks to create one big propaganda unit. Xi Jinping has called for absolute loyalty from state media. Is he getting it? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Daniel Bage. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, a professor of modern and contemporary history at University College London, and Russia analyst and writer Stephen Diel. Welcome both of you to the program. We start today's edition of Midori House in Brussels, where UK Prime Minister Theresa May is in town for the European Council Summit, where it's widely expected that she will push for some sort of joint statement condemning Russia for the poisoning of former spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter in Salisbury. So, Kathleen, perhaps we'll start with you. What exactly is May seeking from her European counterparts?
Well, she needs two things. I mean, European-wide condemnation is not going to be very strong because certain countries like Hungary and Greece, and to a lesser extent Italy, have better relations with Russia, do not want to condemn Russia in quite the same way. The point is that mainly these are bilateral negotiations. It's country to country. And so therefore, she needs this at least as much, not necessarily public relations, that devalues what it is, but she has to, in a sense, demonstrate that Europe as a whole backs what's happening. And that means that it's going to be a not the strongest condemnation that we will have ever seen. But she has strong support from France and Germany and the United States. So she's got the strongest ones behind her.
Stephen, what else will Theresa May be seeking?
As far as Russia's concerned?
Yeah.
Whether she will discuss the World Cup, it's something which Boris Johnson has raised a couple of times, the foreign secretary. And yesterday he described it as that Putin would use it in the way that Hitler used the 1936 Olympics. The Russians have deliberately misinterpreted that and said, oh, it's insulting to compare us with Hitler. That wasn't the point. The point was that it's that juxtaposition of sport and politics. You know, people often say, particularly sports people say, oh, you shouldn't mix sport and politics. Sport and politics have been mixed since Roman times. And indeed, in 1936, Hitler used the Berlin Olympics as a way of showing how great the Third Reich was supposed to be.
Backfired, didn't it?
And it did rather backfire. But undoubtedly, Putin will try to use the World Cup to say, look how, you know, what great progress Russia has made. And as someone who was in the Soviet Union in the whole build-up to the 1980 Olympics, and having seen what effect the American boycott had then of the Olympics, and indeed 60 other countries boycotted, and what that meant to Russia, it really slapped them in the face. A boycott of the World Cup if it were England, France and Germany, that would really hurt the Russians.
This is the first known use of a nerve toxin since the Second World War. Already, this is the biggest escalation of tensions since the Cold War. If it is proved that Russia was behind this poisoning, how then will that shift the dynamic between Europe and Russia and even the U.S., say?
Well, the scientists have shown that undoubtedly this nerve agent came from Russia, which means there's only two possibilities. Either it was state-sponsored, or they've lost control of it, and it's somehow rogue agents have got hold of it, which seems unlikely, even in the chaos of the breakup of the Soviet Union. That was in the 90s. Even then, they managed to keep control of things like chemical weapons and nuclear weapons. And had, even if they had not done so, by now it would have expired. It wouldn't have the same effect. Mm. So it really, it's in my mind, there is no doubt that the Russians are behind this. And it's a way of sending a signal to other Russians who've left the country with and have insulted Putin. Putin doesn't forgive. He and his circle are of that mindset that if you've insulted Russia, if you've insulted him, then they want revenge. And I think the slogan which came up at the time of the Litvinenko assassination in 2006, which also clearly was done by the Russian state, the phrase which is most appropriate, I think, is that revenge is a dish best eaten cold. So to my mind, there is no doubt about who is behind this. And it will be something of a battle, I'm sure, behind the scenes for Mrs. May and her team to be saying to the Europeans, look, this is we have the evidence. And I'm sure they have much more evidence than they've actually released. And in which case, Russia has to be punished for it. You cannot allow chemical weapons to be used on the streets of a European country.
But then what can Russia, what can Britain do if she doesn't have, do we actually think that the American intelligence agencies or the Germans or the French are going to jeopardize fundamentally their relationship and open up their own citizens to revenge, as you say? I mean, that's the problem, is that they can all sympathize with Britain. They can say, and they can see that Britain has more to lose, including all of this really rotten money that's around. But because Germany and France have not yet been attacked, they have everything to lose in that sense. So I will be a bit surprised if they all march shoulder to shoulder, swords in hand, saying, we're going for Russia.
Well, they're not going for Russia in the sense
of...
You know what I mean. What are they waiting for? Are they waiting for it to happen to them? Do they think they're immune?
Probably.
They may get a nasty shot.
I mean, Germany is not the most ferocious anti-Russian country in Europe, is it?
It's not. And
don't forget the gas.
That is the one thing which they really ought to go for. They should stop Nord Stream 2.
Go ahead.
I mean, that's a political project which, extraordinarily, Schroeder is absolutely in bed with Putin.
Schroeder's previous German official position makes that almost more of a betrayal than before, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And it's time that other Europeans stood up and said, this is not right. You cannot allow. It's not as if this is a one-off. We have Litvinenko in 2006. We have the seizure, the illegal seizure of Crimea in 2014 by the little green men that Putin denied, and a year later said, yes, I gave the order to send them in. We have them starting a war in Ukraine. And okay, Ukraine's not a member of the European Union, but nevertheless, it's a war on European territory started by Russia. We have them shooting down MH17, the Malaysian airliner, and we know all the facts are there. We know it was the Russians who did it with a Russian-made surface-to-air missile. There is a history. How long do you let the bully get away with it?
So what do we do?
Yeah, Theresa May has said sanctions won't be part of this. And as you mentioned, Kathleen, a lot of this will have to be done bilaterally. Europe doesn't have much joint competence when it comes to intelligence. And reports from Brussels today suggest any action to clamp down on spy networks will have to be done country to country, as we said. So how then do European countries work together to stop perhaps further attacks, as Putin grows stronger, it seems, and clamp down on the spy networks, which Theresa May says are the real problem?
Well, Lithuania is now considering tossing out their nest of spies, as it were. It's the only country that's actually come out and said that they're going to do it. This is a wake up call, more or less. Belgium, as we know, is a home for jihadists. Mm-hmm. Therefore, being a small, inoffensive country is not protection. So an awful lot of countries in Europe think that it doesn't matter to them because they have the outside support and Russia doesn't care about them. The fact that Russia is infiltrating a number of the countries in a number of ways, not just going after, you know, the tweets and so forth, but purchases, cadres that are being cultivated, means that what has to happen is that these other smaller, inoffensive countries, shall we say, are going to have to realize that they're part of it, that borders are not going to stop. They aren't going to sort of go around Italy because they've not been nasty, if you see what I mean. So I think it depends on public opinion in those countries as well, doesn't it? What's going to happen to elections? What are the newspapers doing? What are the oppositions doing? There's an awful lot that Theresa May cannot do, that she's going to have to depend on her colleagues in Europe, which we are now leaving soon.
And you mentioned the complications as well because of the oil and gas deals as well, so much energy coming into
Europe. It's not just the deals, is it? It's the fact that much of Europe is now dependent on I was going to say Soviet, on Russian oil.
Sure.
And if they threaten Nord Stream 2, I mean, what can Russia say, right? We'll turn it off.
There are alternatives. I mean, as far as Nord Stream 2, it's a gas pipeline. There is gas, plenty of gas and plenty of reliable gas from Algeria, for example. The only reason we don't get much of it in Europe is because the French and the Germans have stopped the pipeline, which carries it through Spain and into France. They stopped that because of pressure from the Russians. There are alternatives. So there's stories today, there's been more oil and gas found in the Mediterranean. You know, there is an option there.
And Kazakhstan, for that matter. Who are trying to be independent of Russia?
Yeah. I mean, that's another whole story, but which unfortunately we don't have time to get into. One thing which, again, I fear me, they won't have the strength to do it. But one thing which the Russians are really worried about, and it's not oil and gas, it's banking, it's SWIFT.
Sure.
The SWIFT transfers, that is one thing which almost makes Russian bankers go pale if you say to them that they would be excluded from SWIFT transfers, because that would really mess them up. And that's something that would be affected.
So many implications as well with the clampdown in the city of London, which is a big center of that finance and a lot of those deals. So I want to stick with Russia now, but focus on the relationship specifically between U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Without surprise, Putin was reelected for a fourth term over the weekend and managed to get 3/4 of the vote. Read into that what you will. But in briefing notes about a phone call with Mr. Putin, Mr. Trump was urged not to congratulate the Russian leader and did so anyhow. Meantime, the Trump administration still deciding how to respond to the poisoning of Sergei Skripal in England and what measures against Russia are expected. So Trump has been bullish on trade. Today, he announced new tariffs on China, and there are signs indeed that he will get tougher on Russia. So, Stephen, why does he care about his personal relationship with Vladimir Putin?
My own feeling, and this is just a feeling, I don't have any secret information which I can reveal or not reveal, but my own feeling is that the Russians definitely have something on him. Mm-hmm. There was, of course, this dossier which was produced by Christopher Steele at the end of 2016, which had some rather sensational revelations as well as some hard-hitting revelations just generally about Trump. Undoubtedly, there is some kind of file on Trump. Anyone who has been to Russia regularly, or anyone who is a big businessman, big politician, anyone is bound to have a file in the FSB, the old KGB headquarters. That's just the Russian way of doing things. And if you'll forgive the pun, it seems this time they came up Trumps. So there is going to be a file there. And if Trump did do something that he shouldn't have done, he will be aware. He'll know it's there. And that is an explanation. That is a logical explanation for his behavior, for the way, you know, he's told don't congratulate Putin on his election, so he goes and congratulates him. The way in which, you know, he has played this sort of hot and cold game with Russia, and my feeling is that the Russians are waiting for a moment where they might think, okay, look, we'll chew him up and spit him out. It may come, for example, if he's going to run for re-election, which is likely, after the end of the 4-year term, they may decide, we'll have someone else now, because he hasn't been as reliable for them as they expected him to be. And they might just release something which could finish him off. That's a possibility. They've done, for example, just to give you a concrete example, I know they've done this with diplomats in the past. They've, going back some years, I knew personally of someone who they harassed them. They, you know, they made it clear they were listening to their phone calls back to England. They would go into the flat and not turn off the freezer, but turn it right down. So gradually over 4 or 5 days, everything would defrost. They really, you know, it's kind of psychological warfare. And then after about 11 months of this, there was a tit for tat expulsion of diplomats. At that point, this particular diplomat was expelled because they chewed them up, spat mm-hmm. them out. So that's a Russian way of acting. So this, you know, sort of watch this space. There may well be revelations that eventually come from Moscow about Mr. Trump.
Alternatively, or supplementing it, of course, is that Trump really has gone to the point he does not like being told what to do. He now feels that he is president and knows how to be president, and he says he always follows his own instincts. In this case, he leads with a gut or what other part of the body you like to substitute for that. And he has made it very clear that there's no one in the White House as clever as he is. He has decreasing respect for his assistants or his advisors. And therefore, one almost gets the idea that he is showing his own power by not doing what everyone knows he is told to do or advised to do. And everyone says Russia's awful, and he's saying, I make deals. You know, I know what I'm doing. Russia's a strong man. I'm a strong man. We can work together in a way that you pygmies cannot. So I think in addition, you're the Russian specialist, Stephen. I'm pretty sure you're right. But in addition to that, I think Trump just likes to show who's boss in Washington.
Thumbing
and the best way to do
advisors,
the best thing he can do is to say, I'm not paying any attention. I know what's right, and I'm going to do it.
Well, increasingly, there seems to be that tension. Hours before he was fired in a tweet, former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson told reporters he was increasingly concerned about Russia. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster has also pressed Trump to get more firm on Russia. He was slated for doing so. And today, Trump's lawyer on the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation walked away from Mr. Trump in the White House. So does Donald Trump have a point in saying his predecessors really weren't hard enough or didn't do enough to build a relationship with Russia?
No, I don't. I agree with Kathleen as well. That, you know, I think that there is him, you know, thumbing his nose at his own advisors and having, you know, he is someone who, for reasons best known to himself, is super confident of his own abilities. Mm-hmm. But he does seem to see the whole world and his particular position now as the game show host he once was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is unreality TV, if you like. He blows hot and cold in it because he's done extraordinary. One of the most extraordinary things he did was after the Syrian chemical attack in April last year, when he then launched missiles against the Syrian Air Force. And in fact, in doing so, it wasn't really made too much of at the time, but in doing so, he showed the incompetence of the Russian missiles, which was the anti-missile missiles, because mm-hmm. none of them worked, despite the fact the Russians claimed they did. They didn't. All of the American missiles got through. And that was a real shock to the Russians. What? He's doing this? He's actually launching missiles. He's going against our Syrian ally. So that's one of the things where they really sort of sat up and take notice. Because at the start, when he was elected, I mean, there was a member of the Duma, the Russian parliament, who said, opened champagne and said, you know, we have our man in the White House. Mm-hmm. Well, he hasn't proved to be their man in the White House, and yet he does still play this hot and cold game. It is, it's extraordinary.
And we shouldn't forget, just as a final thing here, that Kissinger says, well, maybe Trump is doing things that no one else could do in reference to North Korea. In other words, the great foreign policy specialist of the 20th century, so he thinks, possibly is the case, as has now thought that Trump actually isn't as bad or isn't as destructive, might actually be constructive, as everyone else thinks.
As it continues to seem more suspect, his moves as Trump and the White House are indeed being investigated over these ties. Trump continues to play that game, and what it is, we shall find out, as you suggest. Perhaps it does have to do with building a good relationship with Moscow over North Korea. Kathleen and Stephen, thank you. We're going to take a short break now, and after this, we're going to turn our attention to the Netherlands.
The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns for a fourth year, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panelists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality. Whether you're an architect, city maker, retailer, media mogul, or chef, pick up a ticket and be part of the debate on upping quality of life across the board. This year, there will also be a special focus on entrepreneurship and making it in the city. We'll be diving headlong into all Zurich has to offer, from fine food, Swiss wine and river swims, to private tours of the best shops and ateliers. So why not join us from the 28th to the 30th of June? Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here with me, Daniel Bache, Kathleen Burke, and Stephen Diel. The Netherlands has just narrowly said no to new data collection powers for the country's intelligence services in a referendum. And just under 50% rejected the powers, while a slightly smaller number were in favor. Clearly a divisive issue. Has the debate just been put on hold for now, do you think?
When it's as close as that, I think so. I mean, it's literally sort of 47 point something said yes and 48 point something
yeah,
said
exactly.
No. So it's you think, well, and they like having referenda in the Netherlands, so they may well come back to this one. But it is, it's what struck me when I heard about this as particularly extraordinary was, you know, there you are, okay, you have a slightly larger number sort of saying, oh, no, we're not going to let the intelligence services have our data. I wonder how many of those people have put so much of their own personal data on Facebook or other social media, and they don't even think about that. You know, this obviously is a really hot topic at the moment with Facebook coming under attack for letting personal data out. So it just, you know, it just struck me that there's as often with referenda, as we know in this country, you know, people don't always think things right through to the end.
Of course, the thing about also the Dutch, in a sense, it was two things. One, the government was a bit dumb. It's okay because this is a non-binding decision, so it depends on whether it wants to go against ... The last three referenda have been no. You'd think that the Dutch government would have looked back to see that the chances actually of getting the answer they wanted were not as overwhelmingly hopeful as it might have been thought. But again, you know, the Netherlands does not feel, the people don't feel threatened. You know, you have to feel threatened to be willing to give personal liberty, as it were, to a central state, because governments don't give it back.
Well, part of the argument here is that intelligence services may be able to thwart attacks or learn more about terrorist networks. But, I mean, perhaps coming in a week of this fallout with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, people are more concerned about their protection, their privacy.
I'm sure that news story about Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, I'm sure that had some influence on it. But I just wonder how many of them did think, you know, how much of our data is on Facebook? Because people do tend to, I'm not on Facebook. I hasten to add, I use Twitter, but I mean, I just find it extraordinary, you know, that people send messages about, you know, wow, you know, I've just had a great breakfast, this sort of thing. And maybe now with the Cambridge Analytica story, you know, people are beginning to think, oh, you know, actually how much about me is out there? And you know, how much can anyone access? Anyone who knows, you know, who's more computer literate than I am. And so perhaps that had an effect. It would have been very interesting if they'd had the vote last week. Would it have gone the other way? Who knows?
Should we then limit the access either way? I don't know, in legislation, how much access intelligence agencies then do have? We understand that all kinds of other bodies have our information, but when it comes to intelligence services, should our governments be protecting us?
Well, it depends on what the first and irreducible duty of a government is defense of the realm. Mm-hmm. Now, that means, do you trust your government to have that particular particular duty as top. Then, of course, you go down. Do you trust your government to stop when it ought to stop? And then you go down and you think, no, the Home Office always asks for more than anyone wants to give it. And maybe the best is the enemy of the good in that sense. But I come back. I mean, I'm on neither Facebook nor Twitter. I just don't trust having anything out there, you know, but that shows how antediluvian I am. I agree with Stephen. Why are people telling all this out there? And they must know, but they probably don't think about it. I guess, I think it comes down to how threatened does a population feel. Mm-hmm. If they feel threatened, they'll let the government do it. If they think the government is more of a threat than an external threat, they'll be more unhappy about it.
And that's the extraordinary thing. You know, in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. you would have thought that they would actually trust their government. You know, the Netherlands, it's hardly a dictatorship, is it? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you'd think, well, it's the intelligence services we're talking about here. We're not talking about sort of some strange body that we don't know what they are, and it's rather like the argument about CCTV cameras.
Sure.
You know, that apparently this is maybe a rumor, but you know, we have more in this country than anywhere else. We have, you know, you just about any road you drive down in Britain now, you know, you'll pass a number of speed cameras. There's different sorts of speed cameras. It used to be you'd look out for the yellow box. Now there are all sorts of different ones. With the Skripal case recently, you know, what was one of the first things they can't have photos of Sergei Skripal and his daughter because they're in hospital. But what they did release was a CCTV footage of him buying something in a shop. Mm. You know, we are actually, you know, we're filmed far, far more than we realise. And actually, you know, I'm not doing anything illegal, and that doesn't worry me too much. If it means that they can apprehend someone who is doing mm-hmm. something wrong, then maybe that's a good thing.
I want to turn the page just lastly and talk about China. The ruling Communist Party has announced plans to merge state TV and radio stations to create a new broadcaster, the Voice of China. TV, film, newspapers, and the internet, all heavily censored, as we know. But now the party's Department of Propaganda will be taking over news media. Xi Jinping has been calling on state media to pledge absolute loyalty to his party. Is he on his way to getting his wish, Kathleen?
Oh, he's on his way to getting his wish in anything he wants to do mm-hmm. at this point. I will admit that in my past misbegotten middle age, I have appeared on CCTV a number of times till my son-in-law told me just precisely what I was appearing on, and then I didn't any longer. Because when you deal with the individuals like that, it isn't clear. I mean, they're, you know, you can talk to them and they don't try to censor and so forth and so on. But what he has done now is made it entirely clear that any Chinese media of any sort is under, theoretically, his control. The thing is, who is he appealing to? I mean, some of the programs are in English. A lot of the programs are in Mandarin, obviously, or in various of the Chinese languages. Is the idea that he's going to consolidate his control in the Far East? That's quite probably fairly high up there. Is he going to try to disarm American opposition? Well, good luck to him on that one. But they do have an important studio in New York. So the question is just how focused is this going to be? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of varietals and a lot of different elements. And the man is not yet God.
One of the things that struck me was thinking Africa. I mean, mm-hmm. There is huge Chinese presence in Africa mm-hmm. now. And as someone who used to work for BBC World Service, where, you know, Africa was a key audience, maybe they see that as an area of competition. I mean, this whole question of international broadcasters, many people found it, certainly sort of Russian, for example, I spoke to, found it difficult to understand how in those days the World Service could be financed by the Foreign Office but editorially be independent, and it genuinely was. Mm. But if you're talking Russia or China or countries which are which don't have political pluralism, shall we say, then clearly, you know, they are owned by the state and they are going to be the mouthpiece of the state. I mean, Russia today, RT as it's now called, actually it's in its constitution that it is to be the Kremlin's mouthpiece. It's not supposed to be an independent broadcasting organization giving an independent view. It gives the Russian view. Thank goodness the World Service does still retain its independence.
Well, inside China, this all does seem to fit the 1984 narrative. But outside, with the unified message that Xi Jinping is trying to push, we wonder then how effective this consolidation will be. And I guess time shall tell. But we'll have to leave it there. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Kathleen Burke, Stephen DL, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show produced by Carlotta Rabella, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Amber Roberts. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music coming up next with me. And then at 1900, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily later at 2200 London time. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Daniel Bache. Goodbye.